Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. When the growth of a black college ran up against Baltimore's racist housing codes a century ago, white opponents protested, raising concerns about integration and the property rights of colleges. In 1917, Morgan College, now Morgan State University, an historically black college, purchased a large plot of land near Herring Run, just south of Lauraville, a neighborhood in northeast Baltimore. The college's plan to construct homes for African American students, faculty, and guests spurred a series of legal challenges by the residents of all-white Lauraville. Here to tell us the story is Stephen Ragsdale. He's a local historian as well as a guest lecturer for graduate programs in healthcare and education. He'll be giving a talk about Morgan's controversial move next Thursday, March 15th, at the Village Learning Place in Baltimore. The event is organized by the Baltimore City Historical Society. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Sheila, for having me.
Before the move to Lauraville, Morgan College's campus was in West Baltimore. What prompted the relocation?
Size and space, actually. They were located on Fulton and Edmondson Avenue in West Baltimore, right outside of Edmondson Village. And it was their second location. They had been in that location since about 1879, and they had grown to about 1,500 students. And they were just pushing out of the walls, and they needed additional space. And so the college set out to find a space that would accommodate them, given the complex set of housing and neighborhood ordinances that had been put in place in 1910. They were caught between a rock and a hard place. The interesting note about the story was that Andrew Carnegie had promised a $50,000 grant with the condition that they build a building with his name on it on campus. Well, given the strict social and housing rules around Baltimore, building a building with Andrew Carnegie's name on it on Fulton and Edmondson was going to be a difficult charge. I mean, and so the trustees were charged with kind of finding the in-between space. Where can we move, given this complex set of ordinances, so we can get the money?
On May 2nd, 1917, the Baltimore Sun reported, quote, "Lauraville has blood in its eye for any invasion of its 99% pure white community by a Negro institution, colony, or settlement of any kind or character," end quote. Set the scene for us. Why was Morgan's decision to move to Lauraville so controversial?
Well, there's the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist, if you will. I mean, if you think in terms of like around 1917, it's just 10 years after that ordinance, Baltimore Ordinance 610, which segregated neighborhoods racially when it came to housing, schools, and neighborhood businesses. And so this was a construct that Morgan, by virtue of it being an African-American college, had to face. A second condition was Baltimore was, at that point in time, 10, 12 years after the fire, was very expensive.
The Great Fire of Baltimore.
Yes. I mean, there had been this infusion of money back into the city, and land was valuable. You know, and so property rights, who purchased, where you purchase, were all critical questions to land investment and land usage, if you will. And so this idea that this small black college in a town that is, you got to remember, Baltimore is only about 20% African American. They are the minority at that time and living in tightly confined spaces, either in Old West Baltimore or close to Old Town. And so like finding a space outside of that was extraordinarily difficult.
And this was to be not just classrooms and administration, this was to be residential space also.
This is residential spaces and businesses.
What kind of businesses?
Barbershops, mom and pop shops. If it was a majority white neighborhood, black businesses could not reside on that block. You know, and so The spirit of the times is land is extraordinarily expensive. It's coveted. Values are increasing exponentially. You have a lot of outside investment. Real estate investment is huge at that point in time. And Larville was actually not the first place that Morgan would look at in order to secure a land. Larville was actually, according to my notes, like the 50th site that they'd looked at. They started pioneering, or if you will, looking for land in 1913 and were rebuffed by the Park Heights community. The Park Heights community was, from my understanding, a large community of real estate investors. And so they were able to successfully get an injunction to prevent Morgan from moving. The space that Morgan had looked at was called the James Ingram property up on Park Heights, where Smith Avenue is now, all the way down to like 7 Mile Lane. But it was a nice little plot of land. There was a new country club that had opened up 3 or 4 years earlier. Well, you can imagine, they were not comfortable with this black school or this African-American school moving to land that they saw as coveted.
But in terms of the value of the land, I mean, once a deal had been struck, a price had been struck for the land to be sold, mm-hmm. once the leaders of Morgan College had negotiated a price for the land, why was that still an issue?
The legal case was predicated on this issue that Morgan had exceeded its charter, that they had been chartered to educate Negroes. And any venture outside of that was exceeding its charter. I mean, so by this being a real estate deal, one of the things that circulated was the rumor mill. What were they going to do with the property? You know, how were they going to use the property? One of the rumors that was pretty much solidified was that they would build a community behind the college, no matter where that was, for its faculty and its staff, because it was going to be in a white community. Any black community would have been far off.
Any place where they could have lived.
Where they could have lived would have been very difficult for them to go back and forth to on a daily basis. I mean, so there was an intense effort by the school to create a community close to the school. The white community in Larville and other places got wind of this and thought that this would drive property values down amazingly. I mean, there was good reason to think this. I mean, there had been public health reports written in 1907 that moralized the way that black people and white ethnics who didn't speak the language, it moralized how they lived. I mean, and so it wasn't the condition that they lived in. It was the fact that these people were bringing ills towards white communities and destabilizing them economically. I mean, and so Morgan got swept up in that fever. It didn't matter that they were educated. It didn't matter that the large contingency of the folks who were waging the battle were white on both sides. Morgan's first 5 presidents are white men. So there are powerful white factions on both sides having a real estate fight, if you will.
How many homes were to be built in this expansion plan?
I want to say 147. The important story about that is not the number of houses that were built, but the fact that Morgan trustees were asked over and over if they intended to build houses for the African-American community, and they denied it repeatedly. They denied it in the press. This case was litigated in the Baltimore Sun, and they were constantly being asked, what do you plan to do? And Morgan's John Goucher, the president of the Board of Trustees, and President Spencer said over and over that they planned not to build houses. Well, I found documentation. Well, I didn't find documentation. The documentation exists at Goucher College. Letters where President Spencer was literally making plans with the trustees and the professors to build that community and to sell those plots while they were in the planning stages of purchasing the land. They always planned to build houses, but denied it in public.
And were these envisioned as houses for Morgan's faculty or general housing available to African Americans?
For the faculty, the African American faculty in particular.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with historian Stephen Ragsdale about the opposition Morgan College, now Morgan State University, faced in the early 20th century as it moved and expanded. So tell me how the residents of Lauraville protested.
Vigorously is the best word that I could use. They actually heard about the rumor from a neighbor. The campus that Morgan sits on today was considered Lauraville. The Ivy Mill property and Morris Mock owned the property below what's now Cold Spring Lane and Helen Road. So they were two divided tracks. Well, Morris Mock got wind that the Ivy Mill property was for sale and was actually part of the original protest, you know, before he would sell his land, right? There was essentially a group, Lauraville Community Improvement Association, gathered and would raise thousands of dollars in a couple of days.
That's a lot of money in the early 20th century.
Right. I think the figure was about $7,000 in a, you know, in a night or two, right? Which is extraordinary.
And they used it how?
They used it to wage a public campaign. One of the things that they would do is they would initiate legislation in Annapolis by a Towson representative, Representative Givens, who had essentially created a bill to settle the ill feelings, potential ill feelings between whites and blacks by selling this property, right? And so what he wanted to do was prevent Morgan from building within 5 miles proximity of what is now Towson University. I mean, so there were several strategic moves. Another move would a lawsuit where four couples would enjoin Morgan, seek an injunction to prevent them from building on land that they had already purchased. They wanted to prevent them from building on this land.
And that case, am I right, went to appeal?
That's the Diggs v. Morgan College case. That would go to appeal, go in front of an 8-judge panel. Judge Stockbridge from Baltimore would write on the case, and essentially the findings were that Morgan had the right, that they were well within their right, beyond their charter, to, as property owners, to do what they wanted to with the property, and no one could prevent that sale. And this was kind of a big deal. This was, Baltimore had written that housing rule in 1910. That housing rule would get exported to 35 or 40 cities around the world, written exactly as is. So the language did not change from city to city. And so this was a way of segregating cities across America. Well, you can imagine that this would lead to lawsuits because it was a conflict, if you will, about what you could do with your land. In particular, as a white person. So it wasn't about like what black people could acquire, but you as a property owner, as a white property owner, what could you do with your land and could you sell to whomever you chose? Well, that would be settled around the same time that the Morgan case would be settled, in Buchanan v. Worley in 1918, right? And so this settled segregation law around how you could sell and dispose of property.
And it held what? The decision in that case held?
That segregation was illegal. Neighborhood segregation by ordinance was illegal, and it infringed upon people's property rights.
But that wasn't the end of segregation.
Restrictive covenants are the next iteration. You write covenants into your neighborhood deal that prevent you from selling to whomever you'd like.
So after Morgan College acquired the land and the lawsuit went their way eventually, did they get the grant from
Yes.
Andrew Carnegie?
Yes. And so the Carnegie Building would be one of the first buildings built on campus. It's still there. It's a big, beautiful stone building. One of the things that I really love about that campus was the early buildings were built with stone from the Heron Run Quarry. There were like 6 mills across Heron Run. And so if you look at those buildings, they're still amazingly, they were well-structured. It's an amazing building.
I don't want to give away too much of your talk, but the neighborhood built by Morgan still stands today. Then it was a haven for the Black upper middle class. Tell us about some of the people who lived there.
Full disclosure, I grew up in Laurelville. I moved to Laurelville when I was about 15 years old, and actually went to Morgan State. It was my first undergrad. It's a cul-de-sac that still exists with one way in and one way out with about 145 brick homes. But if you think in terms of like who's lived back there, well, the Murphy family, the famed African-Americans who started the African-American newspaper. W.B. Du Bois lived back there for about 11 years. I think he began living back in 1939, and he raised a family. This was like right before his Africa venture. I mean, there's a whole host of Morgan professors, but I like to talk about like who visited the neighborhood. Like Theodore McKeldin would be seen in the neighborhood.
The governor, the Republican governor.
The Republican governor, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy. As far as I can tell, it is the first African-American upper-class neighborhood in the country. I have not been able to identify one that was established earlier.
Well, thank you for giving us a preview of what you're going to be talking about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stephen Ragsdale is a local historian and guest lecturer for graduate programs in healthcare and education. His talk will take place next Thursday, March 15th, 7:30 p.m. at the Village Learning Place, 2521 St. Paul Street in Baltimore. You can find links to the event and to the Baltimore City Historical Society at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. Quick break now on the record. I'm Sheila Cass. When we come back, a Stoop story.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.